Welcome to the Veritas Podcast. For even more exciting content, visit our website at www.veritaswbc.com. Enjoy the podcast.
I have a special guest speaker tonight. It's Justin Esquivel, who is over here to my right. And Justin is a counselor here in Kingwood. And so what I've asked Justin to do as he's come in is to address the connection between the Christian faith and depression and anxiety. And an interesting conversation that we had about this, because there are people that struggle with this but try to determine how it is that it meshes. You know, say I've prayed and for God to remove this, and it doesn't seem that God removes this. What's going on there? Or how is it that believers can help people that struggle with depression or anxiety? Or if you're a believer that struggles with depression and anxiety, how do I think through this? And what's the kind of help that I need? And so here's what I thought. You know, every now and again we do these hot topics, and I thought let's just put that topic down and let's discuss it. And maybe at the end of the day we'll all be better off for it. And so I'm going to give the platform to Justin. I welcome him up here. So welcome, Justin Esquivel. Now, if you look up here, a couple of things while he's making his way up. As you know, we are on Menti. So if you go to menti.com, here's the thing. And you enter the code 68743. While Justin is talking, you feel free to ask questions to him. Maybe there's something that he says, and you go, oh, you can ask that question. Now, if your question is maybe off topic, maybe it doesn't get passed through, because we have moderators up there that will pass the questions on to me. And as we get to the Q&A, Justin and I are just going to plop into these chairs, and we're going to just take them one after the other. So feel free to get your phones out. Make sure that they're silenced so that we can all pay attention. And if you go to menti.com, and then you'll see the code, put in the code, I'm sorry, 68743, and you'll be able to see the other questions that have been entered in by other people that will be coming up as we get into the Q&A a little bit later on. Does that sound good? All right, now how many of you enjoyed the coffee tonight? Was it good? Yep. All right, now if you want to help out and offset the cost of that, it's great. If not, that's okay, but if you do, that's what the wooden box is over there for, and we'd appreciate any donation. Other than that, I want to hand it over to my man, Justin. Right. Thank you for being with us tonight.
All right, thank you.
Let's all pay attention.
All right, am I on? Yes. Okay. All right, so when you do make those questions, let's put them on a skill level, 5 being the hardest, 1 being not hard at all. Let's put them about a 2. All right? No, I'm just kidding. So we do welcome questions. I will be excited to answer some of those questions. If they're too hard, I'm going to pass them off to Jeremy, okay? All right, so I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you guys today about anxiety, depression, and where Christianity or where spirituality come in. Ironically, when he asked me to speak on this topic, this has been a journey for me to see how they mesh. I do have a lot of conversations, and when folks walk in, going to see a counselor tends to be a struggle for folks with faith. Not everybody, but with some. And so as we work through some of the content that I have, I'm going to, my goal is to kind of give you an idea about anxiety, depression, kind of just skim over some things. We won't get too deep. Share some observations that I've had and that I actually see in the office. Okay? So let's go ahead and get started. So again, I want to thank Jeremy for having me up here, and I want to say that this is a unique experience for me to speak with you guys in a church, and I also want to say that your church does a phenomenal job having resources for mental health for folks that need it, that are in the congregation. So if there are struggles, Jeremy and the staff here are very active in looking in the community and sending people where they need to go, and that's phenomenal. Okay, so a couple stats just to get us started here. So let's take a moment. It says, according, one in three adults in the U.S. will experience mental illness. 1 in 25 experience mental illness that significantly interfere with life activities. 1 in 5 youth ages 13 to 18 will experience a mental disorder at some point in their life. And 18.1% of adults in the U.S. experience an anxiety disorder. So anxiety and depression are going to be probably more, some of your more common type of mental illnesses here. And among the 20 million adults in the U.S. who struggle with substance use disorder, half of those have a co-occurrent struggle with a mental illness. So just these facts can say, okay, mental health is problematic. It's problematic in America. And I would probably go out on a limb and say that there's not much different between the church and unchurch. Now, there is some leeway there. Maybe if there's time, we can talk about that. But I can tell you this, working with married couples struggle in the church just as much as they do outside of the church. which is an interesting fact. So there's two more facts that I do want to draw your attention to, and this will kind of help us focus in tonight over anxiety, depression, and spirituality. So 2/3 of the people affected with depression do not seek help. That's a large portion. 2/3 of the people suffering with depression do not seek help to address the symptoms related to depression. Now, if you were to take that diagnostic handbook, this is a way that therapists, counselors, psychiatrists will make a distinction on, okay, I believe that you're suffering with this diagnosis. These are some of the markers or some of the criteria that you'll see for depression. And I'm just going to kind of just skim over some of these. Now, if you have some of these, it doesn't mean that you have major depressive disorder. That's important here, okay? From time to time, you may suffer with some of these. So don't look at your spouse and try to diagnose them. We're not going to do that. But if you have a real concern or fear, then I'm going to encourage you, of course, seek a mental health professional. I know that Jeremy's got some really good resources, okay? So here's some of the symptoms. Remember, 2/3 of the folks that suffer with major depressive disorder or with depression do not seek help. This is typically what they're struggling with. They feel sad or depressed nearly every day. They have diminished pleasure in nearly all activities, significant weight loss, insomnia or hyperinsomnia, psychomotor agitation, hard to think, feelings of worthlessness or guilt, struggles to concentrate, and thoughts of death or suicidal ideation. Now, again, 2/3, I'm drawing a big focal point on this. 2/3 of folks struggling with this criteria for at least 2 weeks or longer do not seek help. I wonder why. And we're going to look at that a little bit closer. Now, let's take anxiety. Less than half of the people struggling with anxiety choose to seek help. So let me tell you what they're struggling with. Usually, it's excessive worry, more days than not for at least 6 months, difficulty to manage worry, feeling keyed up all the time, fatigue, difficulty in concentrating, irritability, and muscle tension and sleep issues. So if you're feeling that way, I wonder what would keep you away from going into the counselor. Does that make sense? So my question would be, so what prevents people struggling with anxiety and depression to seek help? Now let me spin something to you here, and this is kind of unique here. So for mental health, there's a stigma, there's a draw, there's reasons why people don't go in. However, I'm going to do a little self-disclosure. When you're a counselor, you're told to limit that in the session. But when you do, it's for a purpose to join with your client to help them feel more normal, more accepted, and it's a way for you to build trust. So I'm going to offer a little bit of self-disclosure here. Now, if we were talking about a medical issue, she's sitting in the back, my wife may call me a drama queen, all right? There's reasons why. I'm currently seeking help for it too, but I'm also working with my faith. So I've been a Christian since I was 8 years old. I've been on staff at a local church, and I'm currently teaching Bible study. So I do want to introduce the component that I am a believer, in that I do align with the Bible, but I also feel that there's a place with counseling, absolutely. So going back to part of me being a drama queen, my first wife, I was married before, she got sick, she had cancer, and to speed up that process of telling the story, she passed away back in 2009. Well, parts of that resonated with me or kind of stuck with me. I became a little bit of a hypochondriac, worried, struggled, and my wife was like, oh gosh. So my wife now, she tells me, there's nothing wrong with you. Now, I am a counselor. However, I go to counseling. I receive counseling, so this is one of the things that I address. So my latest thing is I thought I had something wrong with my esophagus. So I said, Jera, I'm going to go get it checked out. And before I went there, I was praying, Lord, give me wisdom of the right doctor. I did my research. Lord, if there's any test done, ask for a clean bill of health or that it's manageable. So I go there, they do a scope on me, and I wait for the results. I've already prayed up for the results. And this is what the doctor says. Yes, you have some acid reflux, and it's kind of burned your esophagus. I want you to take this pill once a day and do these things. So I want you to introduce this to your life. I said, what's that? Well, don't drink coffee anymore. Well, I just broke that one. Okay? Limit my coffee is my goal. Wear loose clothes. I do now. Don't eat after so-and-so. These are tangible things I can do to increase my quality of life when it comes to medical care. So the thought is then what keeps people who are suffering with anxiety and depression from actually going into a counselor's office. So what I did is I did a little bit of research, and on Psychology Today, there was a therapist that came up with the top 10 reasons he believes that folks do not enter the counseling office. He came up with, people say, well, I can talk to my friends. Cost is an issue, and I understand that. I don't have the time. Can it really help? And it feels weird talking to a stranger. You bet it does. However, if you're with a counselor, his goal is to make you feel comfortable, her goal is to make you feel comfortable, and to develop trust. And I'll talk more about the counseling process, because what I've also learned is that a lot of folks just don't know what happens in counseling. There's a whole mysticism piece. So what are we going to do in here? What does this look like? What do I need to do? So now these are a couple of things that I've picked up and observations that I've drawn in my life working with folks in the office. So obviously they've made it into my office, but it may be a year or two later. They've suffered with anxiety and depression. And as we start to talk, I say, so what finally brought you in, or what kept you from coming earlier? And their comments that I hear a lot are, I wasn't sure how it works. I felt kind of embarrassed. And I didn't think my faith was strong enough, or I thought it was a faith issue. Now, with my Christian individuals that come in that are seeking counseling, this is a common reality for a lot of them, is that there's a tendency for them to believe that, well, maybe it's just a faith issue and I don't have enough faith. All right? So if we don't have enough faith, then we need to work on our faith, and then anxiety, and then the depression will go away. So these are thoughts, right? But if we were to look at some of the major triggers that occur with anxiety and depression, I'm going to list a couple here. So if we think it's a faith issue, what if we open up and we look at the context of there's external factors? So is there a belief that I can continue to work my faith? I can go to Bible study, I can go to church, I can worship God, I can meditate, I can pray, I can work on growing spiritually, but I can also address the anxiety and the depression in my life. I would go out on a limb and say, and I believe, yes, both can happen. Spirituality can be a part of the healing process, but it's important to understand the external factors that have occurred in your life that maybe are adding to the anxiety and the depression. So let me just list off a couple. So if you're looking at anxiety and depression, these can kind of go either way. These may occur as triggers for anxiety or triggers for depression. A death in the family, history of bullying. Now it's unique. I was bullied in eighth grade. I guess that was in the early 90s. And if you're bullied at school, you go home, the home is safe because I didn't have a cell phone. I wasn't on social media, so the bullying didn't follow me. Nowadays, what happens when you're bullied? Well, it follows you home. So that makes its way into my office, where anxiety and depression are linked to bullying. Divorce, marital conflict, this can wear you out. If it drags on and there's not help sought, then that can lead to depression or anxiety. Job pressure. For you guys that are in intense jobs, ladies too, that can also breed a lot of anxiety. Parenting, we just talked with a fellow named Chris. Life is hard, man, when it comes to kids. I was sharing my angst. He didn't say that. But for my wife and I, parenting is hard and it brings stressors. So that can lead to anxiety and to bullying. Ironically, retirement. This is one that you wouldn't think. I worked 40 years. I follow Dave Ramsey. I'm sitting pretty nice right now. This is not me talking right now. Or this isn't me. I'm not there. I've got another 40 years to work, Lord willing. But what's unique is for folks that retire, there is anxiety and there is depression. What's it linked to? Well, you work 40 or 50 years. You walk out. You're set up. But now you lost your meaning and your purpose. So what do you do with that? And so usually the first year and a half to 2 years after somebody retires, there's a struggle for them to kind of figure out where they fit. If they're not plugged in, there could be a source of anxiety or also depression. And then abuse, abuse, and abuse. And I say that three times. I spent time working in a psychiatric field at a hospital. And what I've noticed is that sexual abuse, emotional abuse, and physical abuse. So I worked with children ages 5 to 12. you spend some time working with little kids and you see what abuse can do, excuse me, then you can understand why there's anxiety, why there's deep depression, and other type of mental illnesses that can follow that. Now, if you were abused, it doesn't mean that you're going to suffer from that. But for folks that don't have a supportive family behind that, that are left alone, and there's never help sought, then absolutely these have the potential to lead to anxiety and depression. Now, as I use the example of us going to the doctor, hey, I got a cough, doctor gives you a pill, you're following his treatment plan or her treatment plan. When you walk into a counselor's office, there's also going to be a treatment plan. So if spirituality is keeping you out, then I want you to challenge, okay, can my spirituality, can my work with the Lord, can I grow spiritually and also go and address some of the issues? So what are some of the issues that occur, you know, with abuse and with the marital issues there? So what I would like to do is kind of give you an idea about, well, if we can, and let's say that we entertain the thought, okay, I can grow spiritually. Absolutely. There may be a spiritual shortage somewhere in our life that needs to be taken care of. Well, we can do that, okay? You've got folks here on staff that can help you out. You've got other people in your life, mentors, and you can grow spiritually, but you can also address the other issues in counseling. So let me tell you what counseling is. According to the American Counseling Association, and I actually had a professor that made us memorize this, he would give us quizzes over this. I'm like, man, this is like a master's program, and you're like giving us pop quizzes over the, well, you need to know this is what he said. American Counseling Association says that counseling is a professional relationship that empowers diverse individuals, families, groups to accomplish mental health, wellness, education, and career goals. Now, if I stop there, you would be like, okay, so what I've learned so far is that there's real life struggles with mental health. This is what anxiety and depression look like. These are reasons why I might have it, and so I can work concurrently on my spiritual growth by meditating, prayer, going to church, growing spiritually, but I have no clue what counseling looks like. So I'm going to spend just a little bit of time on what counseling actually looks like. Again, most folks, when they sit down, they'll say, so how does this work? I operate from a theory that helps me conceptualize. It helps me see my client's problem through their eyes. Now, it doesn't happen in one session. It'd be great if it did, but it takes time. So this is where it takes time to build good rapport with somebody. But when they sit down, you can see the nervousness, and my theory tells me, instructs me to watch them, watch the body language, because a lot of their body language, they are unaware of. So somebody's shaking, they're nervous, and their face is flushed, and I'll say to them, you know, you appear very nervous, you know, is this how you feel? And they'll say, absolutely. And then I'll say, you know, you want to tell me more about that? The comment will then say, or their typical comment is, I don't know what I do. Am I doing this right? So I am curious. Do you guys struggle with what counseling is? Just raise your hand if you're not really sure how counseling works. Okay, there's a couple. All right. So as that person settles in, it's the job of the therapist or the counselor, they can go by both, is for us to make a comfortable environment to where this person feels safe, right? Like it said, I'm going to tell my stuff to a stranger. Is that kind of hard? Absolutely. So the first thing that we do is we walk them through, this is what counseling is, and we tell them, this is a safe place for you. There's only a couple reasons why I would ever have to disclose what you're telling me. So if somebody told you, hey, within these four walls, whatever you tell me stays here, as long as it's not abuse to this, 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 or this. So there's about five reasons why a counselor would disclose. So after that's done, then I start to walk my clients through the process. They'll say, what do I do? And then all that I say is just, I want you just to tell me why you're here. And then from there, I look at their values. I do supportive reflection. I listen, so I tell them I'm a professional listener, then I reflect, and like I said, each counselor or therapist is trained to work through a different theory that helps us determine what the issue is. And so I tell them, the more that you talk to me, the more that we probe, the more that we turn over the rocks, the more that we look at your family, at your early life experiences, you're painting me a picture of your life. So this is a roadmap. I said, the more that we do that together, and as long as you trust me, and I jokingly say to them, but I mean it, if you get a creep vibe off me, or if you think I'm shady, tell me. We'll be the most direct we will ever be with anybody else in your life. You tell me, because I won't hesitate to refer you to somebody that I trust. I said, and if there's something about you that I feel like, you know what, I'm struggling to work with here, I'm going to be open and honest. But going back to the painting, the more that we work together over time, we develop trust. The person starts to feel more secure, comfortable, safe. They disclose. We start talking about deep topics, stresses of job. We talk about abuse, family life, whatever is on their mind, it comes up. And the more that they talk, they paint a picture of their life, which helps me identify for them, hey, these are problem areas. But again, the theory that I work from, the more aware that they become of their struggles, awareness leads to change. What drew me to that theory was my walk with the Lord. So is it safe to assume that if you never had heard the word of God and you never became a believer, that your life will look a little bit different? Is that a safe assumption? Can we operate on that? Yeah. And it's stressful when you're walking through your master class and you're doing your internship and the professors keep saying, what theory are you working from? There's literally over 200 theories. I'm like, I don't know yet. Well, you need to find one, so start playing around with them. And one day, it just hit me. I remember sitting there. I had a pretty disastrous session. They record them. These are practice sessions, and then they play them. And long story short, a couple got out of hand. There was a lot of things that were said. I didn't stop it. And then I walk in. I was shaking my head, and my professor goes, all right, we're going to watch Justin's video on what not to do, on how to handle. And it was in that moment that as I was watching that play out, I thought, well, what would lead to change? What changed my life? And what came to me was my walk with the Lord. Because I became aware that I'm a sinner, because I became aware that there's a deficiency in my life, there's something that I need, because I realized that the Lord loves me, that he sent his son, that fostered change in my life. That change then informed me on different decisions, the way that I act, the way that I talk, the way that I look at people, the way that I treat people, the women that I've married. These all, that one piece, that one decision to follow the Lord led to change. Once I recognized that, I thought, okay, I'm going to work with people that are both not Christian and then Christians. And that's perfectly fine, and that's okay. But either way, I saw the power of what awareness can do. And so the goal for me in session is to work with folks to make things aware. So if you're struggling with an anxiety, let's say that you know how you feel, but you're not sure why you feel that way. A counselor, no doubt, can help identify some of the triggers that are leading to what you're experiencing. So if your trigger is this, this, and this, then you start to look at warning signs. Okay, well, warning signs, well, what does that mean? Well, I know that when I get anxious, my face gets red. Excuse me. I tend to get sweaty palms. I tend to sweat a lot. I get rapid speech. My heart beats fast. Okay, once we recognize that happens, then we start looking for coping skills. These are skills that we actually teach people that are helpful. Now, I tell my clients, now listen, if taking deep breaths doesn't help, then obviously don't do it. But let's find something that really works. So working with my client to develop, okay, what does work? I give you this picture. This is just a small, small snapshot of what counseling can do. Now, bringing back the spirituality piece, can you grow spiritually and also work on factors that have affected you in your life? Yes. And it is part of the belief, too, that counseling will help identify, because you probably have, some of you may not know what you're feeling and why you feel that way. And I've been in the profession long enough and been in psych hospitals to see that certain things that have happened in our life in early childhood foster you to act in a way that, okay, this is a unique behavior, but this behavior is associated with this. You may never know that unless you step into the office, okay? As far as that, I think I kind of drank too much coffee, and I was riding off pretty fast there, Jeremy. Okay, I think that's what I have.
So, Justin's going to pull up a chair with me. Was that me or you?
That was me.
All right. So he's going to pull up a chair with me, and I want you to feel free to send some questions in. But I'm going to start. How about that? So let's suppose for a second that a person has chronically and consistently struggled with something like anxiety. Is it really a statement? You know, Scripture says, be anxious for nothing, but in prayer and supplication and so forth. And so a person goes in prayer, like they feel, they're feeling anxiety or they're feeling depression even, and they go in prayer and it just doesn't go away. And as a result of that, they feel like maybe that their prayers are ineffective or God has it out for them or something like that. What are some good ways of kind of thinking through that? And is that common to your experience for believers that do come to you for counseling? Have you run into that before? And what are some good ways of thinking about that?
Would you rephrase that for me?
Yeah, sure. So if a person is praying and saying, you know, God, if you just take this from me, so maybe they're struggling with depression or anxiety, and they say, just take this from me. And it doesn't happen, right? So they go and they pray, and after they say their amen, they go, well, I'm still anxious, right? Or I'm still just as depressed as before I started the prayer. Does that make sense?
Right.
What are some ways of thinking about that would be helpful for a person?
So this is what I run into. This is what has the power to keep people out of counseling, and this is where their faith. Okay. So is it a walk with God issue? And so maybe this is a way that you can look at your faith. Am I actively seeking the Lord? And Paul Tripp says I saw him at a marriage conference, and Dr. Paul Tripp focuses a lot on marriages, and it was at a marriage study. And he said, if there is a marital issue or marital problems, he said, then there's a walk with God issue in somebody's life, either or. And I remember that always stuck with me. And okay, so if there's a walk with God issue, then my thought would be that if you're pursuing the Lord, you're doing everything that you can possibly do, then this may be a time for you to enter counseling to help identify the underlying source of what that is that's causing the anxiety or the depression.
Okay, good. All right, so some questions have rolled in. So are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
These are from Now he knows what I feel like up here, like every Sunday night, right? So here's one. It says this. You mentioned counseling as an additive to the Christian faith, a tool perhaps. And so here's the question. How do you reconcile symptoms that are directly opposed to the fruit of the Spirit? So, for example, impulsiveness and self-control.
Okay. So let's say that there are some biological factors there. And so it's not that I'm challenging what the Lord says, but let's say that you've got biological factors there. ADD and ADHD are two common diagnoses here where folks actually struggle. I'm probably undiagnosed, but my wife could probably attest that I do struggle with concentration. Some folks do struggle with impulsivity, and it may be more of a biological factor than a walk with God issue.
Okay, so in that case, it would be, you get the help that's needed to identify the biological factor and then take the steps that are needed to offset that.
Yes, and one thing that I did not hit on that I meant to was medication.
Okay.
I've also noticed that a lot of Christians, when they come in, they are opposed. Now, I don't prescribe. That doesn't fall under me, but when I refer out, I'm pretty conservative. When I look at somebody and we work and we counsel, and let's say that medication is needed, then this also challenges people's faith. Well, why do I need medication? Is it a walk with God issue as well? Medication, I told my wife, it took me 2 weeks to be a believer in medication, working in a psych hospital. At first, I was like, I don't know if this is really something that I want to ever do, to refer to. 2 weeks in a psych hospital, I would see somebody walk in, they were psychotic or suffering with delusions, and you see them on medication. Within 4 to 5 days, they are stable, they're safe, they're a whole different person. So there are biological factors. There's no doubt.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So on that, and this is maybe an important distinction, you know, what is medication supposed to do and what is medication not supposed to do? So do you see medication as kind of offsetting some of the effects that a person might have, you know, sometimes, you know, a chemical imbalance or something like that? But that's not a substitute for counseling, right?
No, it's not. I'm glad that you brought that up as well. The way that we look at medication, most clinicians will look at medication as it's a source to help somebody become stable, to feel better, to where they can do better work. So evidence does support that whenever you pair medication and counseling together, it's highly effective. Now, what tends to happen, and probably a lot of clinicians would probably agree with me on this, is that sometimes when folks start taking medication, they feel better. It takes the edge off. They stop suffering from anxiety, and then you stop seeing them in the actual office. That is treating the symptoms and maybe not totally the underlying root or cause of what's going on.
Okay. So that would be why, one, stay on the medication, but two, have a holistic approach, which would mean make sure that you follow through with the counseling.
As counseling, and then I would recommend that you maintain your appointments with your psychiatrist who actually is going to monitor that medication. They can make the changes. But also, a lot of my clients, they have plan. Hey, I don't want to be on it. And I'm like, okay, well, that's a great plan. Let's be sure that we add that to the treatment, and let's be sure that your psychiatrist knows. So as they improve, they start to understand more about them, what's going on, and process emotions, then maybe in the future you can taper off and maybe even stop with a psychiatrist's approval.
Good. All right, let's go to another question. Are you ready? Why do you think many depressed youth or teens don't try to get help? And what advice can you give them other than see a counselor?
Okay. What I do see, and this is, so I was an educator for 11 years, and I was thinking about how I actually got to be a counselor. I loved working with kids. I worked 9th through 12th grade, and I spent a year doing 8th grade. That was different. That was really different. But going back to that, I love teaching. I absolutely loved it, but it was more than a job just to teach and me delivering content. It was me to invest in the kids' lives. But what I saw that slowly moved me into counseling was the hurt and the pain with lack of parental support. I saw a lot of that, which motivated me to get into couples counseling. So there's a specialty that a lot of counselors do. I do work with anxiety, depression, but I like working with couples, marriage, and affairs. Those are my go-tos. I really enjoy that, but the purpose of that is linked to the kids. I saw the devastating effect that it has on the kids, and maybe nowadays there's lack of parental involvement. Maybe there's lack of resources. Maybe folks just aren't in tune with what the kid's going through.
Okay. So what do you see are some of the major causes of depression and anxiety in youth? I mean, I'm just connecting it to the question. But if you said, hey, here's the big picture, the things that I most consistently see as a counselor as in terms of sort of causing depression or anxiety in youth, what would you say are kind of top on the list?
If we were in the hospital, I would say it's bullying. That's number one, because of social media, because it doesn't stop. You give I just had this conversation with my wife today and her friend. If you give a 12-year-old, 10-year-old, or an 8-year-old access to a phone, they're not going to make 32-year-old decisions with it. Does that make sense? They're going to make 10-year-old or 8-year-old decisions, and then it can create and foster a type of bullying. The other piece, would you tell me what that last part of the question
was? Yeah, I was just saying, what do you see are the major causes of depression and anxiety in youth?
Bullying, lack of support. I also see a lot of stress. So in areas like this, where it tends to be more affluent, there's a lot of pressure on the child to perform. That's usually kids are in AP classes, pre-AP. There's a lot of pressure put on the kid. And in turn, the kid tends to put a lot of pressure on themselves. And so those are things that I happen to see, and they will either lead to depression or with anxiety.
Yeah. See, several weeks ago, I was sharing something from a study done at UCLA, and they were asking parents, what do you think is the most important thing that you do in the development of your child. And 96% of the parents said, well, the moral formation of the child. So then they went and surveyed the children of the parents, and they said, what do you think the parents most value in you in terms of what they're investing in you? And their answer was accomplishment. Oh. 80%, 81%, if I remember it, said accomplishment is what my parents most want from me. And what wasn't coming out of their mouth had anything to do with moral formation. And I thought that was a pretty, one, I thought that was a massive gap. And also wondered, how did we get there? That the parents are sitting there with this one picture in their head, but the kids are walking with a completely different picture. So I think it's an interesting answer. It seems to coincide with what you're saying. Mm-hmm. That's good. All right, so let's move on to the next one. So how do you feel, I think you've already hinted at this, but we can get into it a little bit more. How do you feel about Christians taking antidepressants?
Okay, so I'm not as opposed to it. Like I said, there's a place for medication. And again, usually this question comes up because, is it my lack of faith? So if it's with grief, so I've worked with folks in grief share in different settings to where grief has led to depression, and it's so devastating that the person struggles to get out of bed. They struggle to get in the car. You know, the antidote to depression and some forms of anxiety are getting out, exercising, healthy diet, counseling, building in supportive features, all these other kind of things are very helpful. But if somebody is so devastated by it and they're having trouble grieving and they're stuck to the bed, they're fatigued, tired, wore out, that medication can give them the boost to help them feel better to where they can get out and start to build momentum and get the help that they need.
Got it. Good. I think this next question really kind of piggybacks on the previous one. Well, actually, it just got bumped. Hang on a second. So how and when does medication play a necessary part in the treatment of depression or anxiety?
With stabilization, sometimes with stabilization. So let's say that you hit a rut, somebody's struggling, and we've exhausted a lot of the resources and the interventions and different ways that we can approach it, then that's when I'll say, because like I said, I'm pretty conservative with referring for medication, but then I'll say, hey, you know what, you very well may be a candidate. The other thing that I see is when somebody is suicidal, homicidal, or they're dealing with psychosis. That's usually, okay, the goal now is to stabilize. Anytime that there's a child that's suicidal or homicidal or dealing with psychosis and or adult, and they're brought to the hospital, immediately the goal is to stabilize. Then once they leave the hospital, they then are pushed out to counseling. And so if the person's not a danger to themselves, they've got healthy supports, but they're dealing with passive suicidal ideation, like, hey, I just want to be here, but I don't have a plan, then they may become a candidate if it's long period or long term. Hey, let's get on medication, see if we can bump this and see what's going on.
Got it. Good. All right. Now this I think follows up with the two questions before when I was talking about youth. And the question is, and has quite a lot of likes, by the way, how can you tell if your teenager is depressed to the point of needing help?
Okay. So some of the obvious features are going to be that they're suicidal. If you find notes laying around, if they're mopey, sad for over a two-week period, you can't get them to do anything. There's crying, there's tearfulness, they have feelings of worthlessness, they feel terrible. There's a direct change in them, then that's when I will start to get concerned.
Okay, so like a two-week period.
So if it's consistent for a two-week period and you're not really sure what's going on and there doesn't seem to be anything getting better, then that's when I would be concerned.
Okay, I got it. Good. So,
and you can always bring them in sooner as well.
Yeah, sure. All right, so when someone tells you that they're struggling with these disorders, it's easy to say, well, trust in the Lord or just go to the Lord in prayer. But here's what they said. That can make things worse. As a Christian, how should we help folks? And here's what I'm taking from the question. What are words that we can say, but also things that we can do that would actually help people?
So instead of saying, well, just trust in the Lord, and I hear this part a lot, just trust in the Lord, just get deeper into Scripture, and then things should feel better. Well, that can be counterintuitive. If you tell somebody that and they do that and they don't get better, then it's like, well, then I've got a massive issue with my faith. But if you say, hey, we are going to support you, we're going to walk with you, we're going to set you up. What's great about this church is that there's lay ministers. So you guys already have a design for somebody to walk with them, but as somebody's walking with them through life, meeting with them, holding them accountable, helping them grow spiritually, you can also say, hey, you know what, you're doing a lot of spiritual work, but I think we can also look at it maybe a different avenue, getting some form of counseling or help.
Okay, got it. So what would be the best way to approach someone that you fear might be struggling with depression, but they are avoiding seeking help? Or I'll even add to the question, they're resistant to the idea of seeking help.
Yeah. If you start to see troubling signs, then sometimes it's best to be direct. Hey, this is what I'm seeing in you. And I've got some really concern, or I've got some true concern for you. If they're a minor, of course, you can talk to the parents. Trust is going to be an issue. They probably never trust you again. But if there's something big going on, then this is something that you can do. You can talk to the parents. You can make a point to say, hey, you know, why don't we meet occasionally just to check in? So you can watch them, and I need to be careful how I say that. If you don't know what's going on, you can be a friend to them. You can tell people within the church, hey, I got some concern. But if they are resistant, that's going to be a tough one.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to get people, if they don't want help,
right.
It's hard to help.
Right. When folks come in for marriage counseling, usually it's like a last-ditch effort for most, not all. You get these amazing couples that come in and they want to do some great work. Hey, we got a couple little snags here, and I'm thinking, man, this is a pretty good marriage. Geez. You know, I'm picking up some good helpful hints from these people. But then you have folks that come in, and you got one foot out the door. That's when they come in. For some folks, that typically is what it is. I'm so miserable that maybe I'll try it. But also, I think the piece that I wanted you guys all to know tonight is kind of what counseling is and what it's not. So maybe the person who's struggling, walking them through, hey, you know what? Maybe if you just do a free consult over the phone with one of these counselors, you can figure out what counseling is. Mm-hmm. Maybe that might be enough to get them into seek help.
Okay. This question says, modern psych holds that man is inherently good and has the ability to fix itself. On the other hand, the Bible teaches that man is inherently sinful and has no hope apart from God. How do those reconcile? Well, the first question for me is the first part true? Is from your studies, you know, going through your master's degree and so forth, is the emphasis in modern psychology that man is inherently good?
That's a loaded question. That's a five.
Oh, wait, those are the ones I have to answer.
Yeah.
I'm going to get rid of this one then.
All right. This one's unique because there's a part. I bet I wrote four or five drafts because I was anxious about talking tonight. And in that, I actually talked about my experience going through the master's program. A lot of folks, I went on a journey to figure out, okay, do I need to call myself a Christian counselor or a biblical counselor? Or can I just be a counselor and serve both? Well, I ended up going to a secular college, great, great place to become a counselor, to learn the trade. But what I came across is that with my professors, there was a lot of kickback. They knew that I was a person of faith. They knew that I was on staff at a local church. And so they would present these type of situations, and they wanted to know, so what do you think about that? So with that, yes, I do believe that there could be some idea or notion that maybe we are inherently good, but that does contradict the Bible. The part that I do agree on that side, though, is that I do believe people have the power to help pull themselves and get help and get better. Now, they do have the power to do that, but obviously from a Christian perspective, with the Lord's help too. But when I'm working with somebody that's not a Christian, they don't want any part of spirituality, we can still make great work, progress, and even totally get rid of anxiety and depression.
So probably the difference, if you went to a counselor that believes that people are inherently good, maybe the difference there would be in their approach that they would take with the person in counseling. Is that fair?
Well, as I think about that, So let me give you a little bit of the ethical background. Because I'm not under a biblical counseling umbrella, because I have a degree issued by the state of Texas, I've got to follow ethical guidelines. And so I tell you that when I work with folks, that my personal beliefs are left over here. My personal beliefs don't make their way in, and although I may have some disagreements, I've got to be very, very careful. I've got to be insightful. It's my job not to press what I believe upon other people. Now, if somebody walks in and they're a Christian and like, hey, can we bring in some, you know, like a more biblical approach? Absolutely, I can do that. But by the ethics that I'm under, it's hard for me. Well, it would be wrong for me to share my views like, hey, I think what you're saying is wrong because this is my belief. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that I've got to meet them where they are.
Okay. But if they ask, there's no problem with sharing, right?
Right.
Okay. Got it. So obviously counselors work from different approaches or even maybe many approaches. Would that be something like case by case? So the follow-up question is, if they work from many approaches, how many visits should be spent with a counselor to determine if the approach is the most effective for your situation?
Right.
Good question.
It is a good question. If you're with a counselor that you like, then you should be able to track progress. There should be periods of check-in. If it's ongoing, there's no end mark, then this is where I would encourage you to meet with your counselor and say, hey, I just want to assess the progress, where we're going. Maybe what we're doing is not correct. And absolutely, whoever wrote that, I agree. If you have concern about the quality of care that you're getting, you need to address it with your counselor. Absolutely. Tweaks may be made, and it may be very, very beneficial for you.
Good. So what do you say to the person that's been to counseling for like a lot of years, and they have this mindset, I've been there, and I've tried that?
That's hard, and that's difficult. It is. I will tell you, because I was a teacher for a long period of time, well, for 11 years, I guess it was not that long, but long enough, there was multiple type of teachers. I also learned that in those multiple type of teachers, some kids responded differently to different type of teachers. So if you have tried counseling and you feel defeated, it wasn't helpful, I'm still struggling pretty bad, I'm gonna encourage you to keep going, to find somebody that you connect with, somebody that you can do great work with. I'm quoting that from one of my colleagues, that you can do great work, because I believe that counselor's out there for you. And if this is why being open with your counselor is very, very important. If you feel like, hey, we're not a good fit, this is something that you need to address in session with your counselor. And if it's something that they recognize too, then there can be a referral.
Got it. Okay, so does counseling have to be disclosed to an insurance company? And or if a diagnosis is achieved, will it forever label on a medical chart?
That's a good question.
I'm
going to tiptoe by this because I'm not 100% sure how this works. So what I will tell you is that anytime you are billing to an insurance, so in my case, I'm cash pay, but if somebody wants a receipt to submit to their provider, usually there's a diagnosis. There's a code that comes from the DSM, the medical handbook for psychology. With that diagnosis, it now will be on file, because now they know, hey, this person's being seen for major depressive disorder.
Okay.
But if it's but if you do work with a provider, and this is why some folks do like cash pay, that diagnosis stays in your chart. There's no reason for it to ever come out of the chart unless you're subpoenaed by the court of law or some other reasons.
Right. Got it. Things are basically beyond your control.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Right. I understand. So what are some practical steps that can help redirect obsessive behavior?
That's a good one.
It is a good one.
Yeah. Hmm.
Like my obsessive desire for a clutter-free environment, you know?
Yeah. What I'm going to do is I'm going to...
It goes back to my childhood, Justin.
It does. So what I will do is I'm going to refer this question out to somebody that specifically is going to handle that. That's a form of anxiety disorder, and I would find somebody that really hones into that. I know that medication can be beneficial, for that. And there's some strategies and techniques. And
okay, so you're saying anxiety is often connected to obsessive behavior. You know, is there anything else? So they were saying, you know, what are some practical steps that can help? I get it. We want to get you the right help. That is a practical step,
right?
But if they're just thinking day to day, some things that they need to be aware of and looking for in what they're seeing as an obsessive behavior from themselves, what are some things that they can do?
If they see it in themselves, again, I think I'm going to pitch this out to somebody that's going to handle that one.
Okay. So,
meaning that you would work with somebody that maybe specializes in that. I know that medication is there, but you can also learn strategies. These strategies, I'm going to leave that to the person that's going to work with us. That's not total my specialty, so I'm going to be very careful in treading on that one.
Okay, got it. This one actually has the most likes right now, which makes me wonder about you people. Here you go. Thoughts on regressive hypnosis?
Goodness gracious.
I know, that's what, but there it is. I'm not even sure what regressive hypnosis is.
So there
but
was,
that's why you're here, see?
So there was somebody.
What they're wanting to know is, should they be hypnotizing people? I'm kidding. So in all seriousness, do you have thoughts on regressive hypnosis?
Some folks do still practice that.
Let me say, what is regressive hypnosis?
That's a good question.
It is.
I know the hypnosis part, but not the regressive part. And maybe that's, somebody did it to me when I was in my master's program.
Hypnosis?
It did. And I was unsure how it worked, and I still am. It's not something that I practice. I'm not sure it's that widely used as well.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Here's a very practical question. Counseling's expensive. And many young people would seek help if they could afford it, but their financial instability is part of the issue. So what do you do?
So this is where you look at your budget and you see where you can take off. Somebody once made a comment to me regarding time. You know, somebody said, I don't have time for this, I don't have time for that. And somebody made a comment to me, you're as busy as you want to be. With that, you can make counseling a priority. It's just whether or not that person wants to make it a priority. You can move cell phone around you. You can move other things in your life, your social life. But I believe that for most people, it's not really, they may think it's an issue, but they can make tweaks to their budget to accommodate for it.
Okay.
And there are areas around here, you know, there are some facilities around here that do offer little to no cost for counseling fees. That's there.
Do most counselors work on a sliding scale that you're aware of?
Some do.
Meaning so they would factor in income and those kinds of things and then make an adjustment?
You'll get a different perspective. If you had five therapists here, I think everybody would probably talk a little bit differently about it.
Okay.
Some say that absolutely, I'm going to work on a sliding scale. You know, I'm going to look at what you make here, and we'll look and see what's appropriate. And then some will say, I feel guilty for charging somebody less than for charging somebody when I'm charging somebody else.
Okay.
So there's different thoughts on that.
Okay, got it. Is the significant increase in the need of counseling based on the lack of close relationships? That's an interesting question. It says, similar to the theory behind the book Bowling Alone, but I haven't read Bowling Alone. Maybe. So you might could skip that part if you haven't read it and stick to the other part. If you've read it, then by all means, jump in. But is this significant increase in the need of counseling based on the lack of close relationships? That's an interesting question.
There was another question that got me thinking about modern day, and when I was talking about parenting or family, if you look at the family unit and you wonder why, well, what's different? In that conversation with my wife today, we were talking about the cell phone use. When people are looking at their phone, and it's not that I'm anti-phone, I've got one of them. I mean, I've got a phone. But let's say that we become more sourced on what's in front of us and everybody's doing that, then you lose the connectivity. And I believe that. And I believe that this is probably a growing trend in our kids. It's for parents, I'm guilty of this. It's easy for me to send a kid with my phone or send a kid in front of the TV versus spending that time connecting. small things that I see. There's lack of families eating at the dinner table. That's huge. This is where I learned how to argue with my dad and my mom and my sister, and we talked about ideas, and sometimes it would get loud and sometimes it wouldn't. There very well could be few of those moments for us to connect with our family, mm-hmm. because everybody's in a separate room, maybe on a phone or with an electronic device. Mm-hmm.
Like the debate at my house around the table, is water wet? And I didn't bring up that question, by the way. One of my daughters did. And I'll tell you the answer another night, because I know the answer. All right. actually, still debated. How do you think childhood attachment style affects a person's parenting ability? So how do you think childhood attachment style affects a person's parenting ability? So once a client has awareness, how do you help them use their faith to get past it and not inadvertently repeat the cycle? So from what I'm understanding from the question is how your family shapes you, and then how that shaping spills over into your family after you're married and you have children and so forth. Yeah. How do you break the cycle?
Right. This happens a lot. There's disagreements on how to parent. There's disagreements on how to have a family. You have somebody that comes from a very close, tight family. Oh my gosh, I could bring my wife up here and we could talk about this. Somebody could come from here and help us counsel. And I'm totally joking, but when you have different, or am I? No. Okay. Families, the way that you're raised, most families are not going to be that similar. Meaning that my wife was raised a certain way, I was raised a certain way. When we come together, I'm like, whoa, this is how we did in my family. It absolutely needs to be this. So how can counseling help that? It can identify maybe the compromises. Mm-hmm. There may be things in your marriage, in somebody's marriage, let me take it off you, things in your marriage, I don't want to point at anybody here, I'll just look up, right? So things in people's marriage that you may not be willing to compromise on, okay? Those are non-negotiables. However, there has to be some areas that you are willing to compromise on. So I keep thinking of the scripture about becoming one flesh, leave and cleave. So to leave each household and emerge and make your own family and to pair your values and what you believe with your spouse. Mm-hmm. And that takes time. Counseling can absolutely help do that.
Okay, good. Here's one. How can we get society to accept that counseling or seeking help is acceptable and it's not taboo?
By talking about it, there seems to be more of awareness, hey, that mental health is an issue. If you turn on the TV, usually mental health is associated with gun violence to some form. But there is awareness. Now, it doesn't always lead to gun violence. Right. You know, these are probably there's anomalies here, but there's more awareness in general about mental health and the struggles that we have with mental health.
Right. Got it. So if counseling is a part of maintenance, once improvement occurs, will you ever tell a client that they can stop coming except when they need to, or will counseling be like a lifelong commitment?
So that's a good question. I was told by a mentor that your goal should be to work yourself out of a job with each client. And when I first began counseling, my job was solution focused. That was more of so that's a theory where you jump in on the problem, you fix it with them, you give them the tools because they have the tools, and then you're done. The longer that I've worked with folks, you start working with somebody, you address an issue, and then, oh my gosh, we got a little bonfire over here burning, and then you address that. But there has to be a goal to where they are increasing their mental health, that they feel better, there's progress, and it's got to be ethical. At some point, you've got to say, hey, look, I think we're coming to a close where we are. You can come in for maintenance once every month, once every 2 or 3 months. Mm-hmm. But your goal should be to work yourself out of a job with each client.
Okay, so let me ask this. So, you know, imagine for a second that you have a person there that they're not the one that struggles with depression. They're not the one that struggles with anxiety, but they are in the home with somebody that does. So mm-hmm. It might be a spouse. It might be a child or something like that. Now, obviously, this will take a toll. It'll take a toll, have an effect on them right. as well. What would you say are some practical steps that they can take for personal care you know, given that, you know, it affects everybody that's in the house. Obviously, it affects the person with depression or anxiety or whatever the situation may be. What would you say would be some practical steps that they could take kind of day in and day out to help them?
So that's a unique question there. Practical steps are getting outside, exercising, running, doing something, getting some alone time, playing a sport. These are things that short term they can assist. If you engage in counseling, so sometimes you have a client that walks into the office and the better client for change is the spouse, but the spouse is unwilling to come. I did a dual path, and so I've got family work and study behind my degree. And what's unique about that is that when you look at a family system, whether it's one mom and two kids or mom, dad, and kids or whatever that it is, that even if the person who's the biggest catalyst for change is not there, once one person begins counseling, that can shake the system. So there's, you know, they call it a homeostasis. There's a balance. This is the way, so this is a circle. It doesn't matter where the circle is, but here's a circle. This is my family. Let's say that I've got some behaviors that are alarming and it causes disruption or dysfunction in my family, and my wife goes to counseling. Because she's in counseling, she's going to learn tools, strategies, ways to interact with me or not interact with me, draw boundaries. What that may do, remember, it doesn't matter where the circle is, but now the homeostasis or the family system has changed. So counseling can actually be beneficial even for the person who's not the biggest client for change.
Got it. Good. All right, now we're slightly over time, so we're going to do one more. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
Hey, you've done well. How do you know if a counselor is a Christian counselor?
Man, that's a good question.
That's a trick question in a way.
It is. So my question would be, and I'm just thinking out loud, I wonder why the person's asking. What are they looking for? And so again, this draws me back to kind of the beginning as I was talking. So if you're getting your spiritual needs met, your spiritual needs are being met at church and with your peers and by yourself doing Bible study, is there a need for a Christian counselor? Now, you may say, yeah, my preference is to have somebody who believes in the word. So this is where I'm going to ask you or whoever wrote the question that if you're looking for a Christian counselor, when you do a consultation on the phone prior to going in, this is where you ask them. But I'm also curious, my curiosity is what is that person looking for in a Christian counselor? Is it the fact that there's a Christian label? So if you look on Psychology Today, you type in 77339, it'll pull up all the therapists in the area. A lot of those will check a box. Yes, yes, I'm a Christian, or they won't check the box, or it may not say anything. So again, what is it that I'm looking for? Two, if it does matter, then what I would do is encourage you to have that conversation with them, because that's meaningful to the person that's asking.
Right. Awesome. Well, that's a good place to stop, partly because we're slightly over time.
Okay.
But Justin, thanks for being here tonight. And if you take a minute just to say thank you to Justin for being here. And, you know, I've known Justin for quite a lot of years, actually, and he's become a good friend. And, you know, as we moved here to Texas from North Carolina, I didn't have a clue that he was even in this town. And so, you know, I'm like, what in the world? And so this topic is important, and in part because of how it impacts individuals that struggle, but also families that struggle. And so we thought that it was worth discussing. Here's the way that I want to end tonight. I want you to understand that the reason that we're discussing this is to put the cards on the table. We're putting the cards on the table. And to say as a church that we make a concerted effort to meet you where you're at and to help get you where you need to be. We can't do that if we don't know what you're struggling with. And so what we would hope is that you would prayerfully consider reaching out to one of the staff members so that we at least can get things going to provide, to help you find the help that you need to get you where, from where you are to where you ought to be. We're on your team. And that's why we thought tonight would be a good start in that direction. So thank you so much for coming. I'm going to be sticking around. Justin will be sticking around for just a little bit. You're welcome to come up and say howdy to him. Thank him for being here. God bless. Have a great week.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about Veritas, visit us at www.veritaswbc.com.